All right, let's look tonight as we return to our study in scriptures, the Old Testament, in 1 Samuel chapter 21, in the life of David. David the king, and David who is a man after God's own heart. And we return to this chapter 21 and 22. I'm going to take both of these chapters tonight and talk about David and the outcasts. David and his friends who are those who are outcasts from the reign and the rule of Saul at this particular time. And so we begin to see what would be a series of events here of chapters in the 20s, the chapter 21, 22, 23, and onward, where we find David in the wilderness, where he seems to be wandering or hiding out or escaping or on the move, never really settling in. He doesn't have a home. He's a homeless man, but not really in that sense. What he is now taking on a new type of leadership in Israel that is denied him in the official capacity, but he is now going to establish himself in this time as Saul is opposing him. Now, David is not of the tribe of Saul. Saul is a Benjamite. David is from the tribe of Judah. Of the 12 tribes, God intends a king to come from actually the tribe of Judah. The scepter will be from there, but not necessarily absolute, but it turns out that way with David. It begins in Benjamin with Saul, but you remember in the earlier chapters here, with the actions of Saul and his behavior, the Lord determines to take the kingdom and the throne away from him and give it to another, and is described as tearing it away, if you remember that from Samuel, as Saul went and let Samuel go, and he grabs a hold of his garment and tears it, because he will not let him leave, because Samuel had just pronounced to him, the Lord is taking away your kingdom, and he's taken it away like a tear. It's not going to be a clean break. Certainly not going to be a clean break due to Saul's behavior and actions. And we'll see that as we have already seen Saul making attempts to put David to death. And David cannot stay nearby in the area of Gibeah, where Saul has his main home, and he is in danger, and so he needs to move, and he needs to be on the move and on the hideout. So we want to learn tonight a little bit more what that looks like now. It's David in the wilderness. And it is some wilderness wanderings and different activities that he is engaged in. Now remember, just as a review, David is a man after God's own heart. He's described that way. We learn about him being a warrior, a very successful warrior for the Lord and for the nation. He's a musician. He's a giant killer. He's soon to be the ruler of the 12 tribes of Israel. It's 2 Kings. And there's a nature or a character to David that sets him apart and differently from Saul. And you should be able to see that in these chapters. There's clearly a line here between the character of Saul and his mindset, and it's kind of a paranoia and self-serving one, and David, who is in it to honor the Lord and to follow the Lord's will and leadership. We've learned about David as a model of faithfulness. The scriptures and other places say that he was wholly true to the Lord his God in his heart. It also says he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, did not turn aside from anything that God commanded him all the days of his life, except in the matter of Uriah the Hittite, which we will get to in 2 Samuel. He was a man who's responsible for ordering the worship of Yahweh, bringing it back to a covenant faithfulness. And directing in that way, he wrote 73 plus, more or less, psalms. You could call him, as I've described, the Johann Bach of Hebrew music. He provided the construction of the temple. He designed and enlisted choirs, orchestras, musicians. He invented instruments. He wrote music. And he had people like the sons of Korah and others, Asaph, lead the music for the people of Israel. So he was a man of music, let alone a warrior and a king. These words are ascribed to him. Taste and see that the Lord is good. Ascribe to the Lord the glory due his name. Worship the Lord in the splendor of holiness. As the deer pants for the water brooks, so my soul pants for you, O God. My soul thirsts for the living God. When shall I come and appear before the Lord? And your steadfast love, O Lord, extends to the heavens, your faithfulness to the clouds. Those are just a small little snippet of the poetic mind that he had, the musical mind, the mind of worship that this man David had. That's this king. This is not coming from Saul. Those are not words that you would find in Saul. He began what would be the true government of the nation. He brought it together, as we would say today, and or at least in recent history, a church-state type of existence where there was the tabernacle and the worship and the priesthood and the prophets and the king all working in conjunction together in the worship of God and the service of God and the nation as the people of God. He would bring the tabernacle to Jerusalem, where he made the capital as he took over that city of Jerusalem from the Jebusites, establishing his house there and building and would plan to build the temple there. He brought the ark to Jerusalem. He built this palace there. This would be the center of life now, and this would be that center for years and generations and centuries following. So all of life, both the worship side and the temple and the civic side where the king ruled and the judges ruled, all of life would find itself centered together in this place. This would be his way of uniting the nation, something that Saul never was capable of doing in the years he was there. If anything, we find Saul now dividing the nation. And worse yet, we'll see tonight that he would be very vicious towards what would be the religious side of the nation. He was an incredibly successful general, of course, defeated Goliath single-handedly, inspiring Saul's army to then rout the Philistines, and this would be one of many examples of his leadership as a warrior. He developed a strong, skillful core of warriors and generals around him. You're going to see a few of them and where they came from at this time in the chapters tonight that we'll deal with. He had unprecedented success against his enemies. The Amalekites, the Ammonites, the Edomites, the Moabites, the Philistines, the Syrians. They took major losses from David's reign, and some never really recouped their heights of success again. They became weak subjects of David's Israel. Now, maybe some generations later, they rose up and became a thorn in the side of Israel, but that was due to the weakness of the kings then. During David's day, all of them became subject and fearful of this man. You'll see an element of that tonight. His successes enabled his son Solomon to reign, and to reign with the broadest and the widest part of the borders of Israel, with great success, great wealth, allies with some of his border nations. At the height of Israel's history would be David's son because of David's exploits. It would not be because of Solomon necessarily. His relationship to God was unlike any other king that followed, and all the other kings that followed who sought to be faithful were measured up against David, measured according to David's faithfulness. That's something to be said about this man. He was a benchmark, therefore, of faithfulness and love and true devotion to God. He lived and ruled, for the most part, with a constant fear and respect for the Lord and his will and the presence of God in his decisions and his actions, seeking the Lord for decisions, seeking the prophets and the decisions, looking to the priests and their leadership, looking to Samuel, looking to the others. This would be his mark. God chose his house to be, as a result, if you could say that, in the temporal sense, obviously the Lord is sovereign and has his ways and he's not waiting for man to make decisions. But there's something here of a reward that God chooses his house to be that tree, that stump from which the messianic kingdom, the king, would grow from that household. Now, David's sins aside, his failures aside, that tells us that David is not the Messiah, that there is one greater than David to come. But we find this man here. And it is a great little history to walk through. A lot of chapters here in the history books that sometimes we just kind of read through, and that's interesting. I just want to bring them together. I want us to see the example that we find here. We want to see the Lord interacting here and how truth and integrity and sin and trials and opposition come into play in a man's life here, in this person's life, and how he responds and how the Lord will be a part of this. So let's take a look tonight. We're coming to chapter 21. And this is the time of David's wilderness wanderings, hideouts. This is where his warlordship begins, if that's a word. 4 years, he will be in the wilderness. This will be a test for him, and it'll be a test for us, really, where we now need to make decisions, and we will need to make decisions as David would. Whose company will you keep? Those who are on the evil side, even though they may have the power, even though they may have the influence, even though they may have the wealth, or those on the Lord's side, even though they may be hiding in caves. This would be a big test for all of us. It's easy to go Saul's route, but that's a destructive route. It's hard to go David's road. It's hard to be in David's company at this particular time. Not only is it hard, it's extremely dangerous. But that's the company you must be in. So we want to look at this. I'm going to give you 6 alephs. That's the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet. It's typically an A, but it's silent. And the reason you'll see, because I want to start all of our outline with an A. We'll start in chapter 21. 6 of these alephs of David's wilderness beginnings to see his status an outcast and an outlaw of King Saul's reign. So the first thing we find here in chapter 21 will be Ahimelech and Doeg. Ahimelech and Doeg. This is a chapter where it speaks, these two chapters speak of this one person, Doeg. He's connected to Ahimelech because he murders Ahimelech in the story. And then we find some psalms written in light of these events here. So it's very interesting to walk through this historically, and I want to tie some of the Psalms together to what's happening here so you can see the mindset of David and the heart of this man of God. So let's look at Ahimelech, verse 1 to verse 9. Then David came to Nob to Ahimelech, the priest. And Ahimelech came to meet David, trembling, and said to him, "Why are you alone and no one with you?" And David said to Ahimelech the priest, "The king has charged me with a matter and said to me, 'Let no one know anything of the matter about which I send you and with which I have charged you. I have made an appointment with the young men for such and such a place. Now then, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever is here. And the priest answered David, "I have no common bread on hand, but there is holy bread, if the young men have kept themselves from women." And David answered the priest, "Truly women have been kept from us, as always when I go on an expedition. The vessels of the young men are holy, even when it is an ordinary journey. How much more today will their vessels be holy?" So the priest gave him the holy bread. For there was no bread there but the bread of the presence, which is removed from before the Lord to be replaced by hot bread on the day it is to be taken away. And so we see the first part of this section, and we're introduced to Ahimelech. Ahimelech, his name, Ahi, is the word that means companion or tribesman or friend or brother. Melech is a term that means ruler. Technically, Melech is king, but it could also involve a ruler, one who is a ruler, a companion or a tribesman ruler or a companion ruler. And so here is this man, and he's given this name. I don't know if the name has any implications upon what happens. He's a priest. He's a priest, and therefore he's involved with the tabernacle and probably the chief priest heading up those priests that were living at this time in this place called Nob. Nob is a village about 2 miles from the city currently of Jerusalem. And today, if you were to go to Jerusalem, you would travel a few miles to the north and you would get to a place called Mount Scopus. Mount Scopus is what is considered Nob, where this little village was. In chapter 22, verse 19, we learn that Nob is actually the city of the priests. So here's the gathering where all the priests were, or most of the priests who would attend to the temple grounds, or at least the tabernacle grounds at this point, and serve the altar and care for all these things. And they had those things in their presence. And what is mentioned here is the bread of presence, which was brought every Sabbath before the altar, hot bread, cooked and prepared, 12 loaves, 6 of them on each side. Each loaf represents one of the tribes of Israel. And so this is the scene that shows up here. David is arriving. He's not on an expedition from Saul, as he said. He is escaping Saul. Saul's trying to kill him. So he's fleeing and realizing, I'm in a little bit of trouble here. I need to be careful of my associations and who I talk to. I don't want to get caught. And so when he meets with the priests, he conceals his intentions here by saying, I'm actually heading out because Saul has charged me with this, but it's kind of a secret mission. And so don't tell anybody, and that's what I need, and I need some provisions. And so he's coming to Ahimelech for some provisions. And the only provisions Ahimelech has is this holy bread. And he says, well, you can have these, but if you've kept yourself holy because this is for the priests, then we can give that to you. Levitical law, by the way, required that no one eat this bread except consecrated priests. But there would be no issues, and that ceremonial rule would be suspended to meet human needs, as is the case here. And this is, by the way, one of the areas where Jesus responded to the Pharisees, if you remember, about eating, you know, grain on the Sabbath. Well, did not David eat the consecrated bread when he was hungry, when he had need? That's okay. We don't need to be legalistic about this. And so this is where this scene comes from. But one thing about this is he's concealing his intentions. And I mentioned this before. David's a man who is a wanted man. And he needs to be careful about what he's doing and where he's going and who he talks to and what he reveals to everybody. And thus, this may be a justification for him to lie, which is what he's doing. And some would say you shouldn't have lied. You should be honest with this because Ahimelech actually is on your side, but he doesn't know that. So however you play that ethical issue out, it's part of the narrative. It's not my point tonight to try to justify David or accuse David, but there are a few ways to look at that. Life-threatening hazards, kingdom-menacing risks are going to attend David wherever he goes. So he has to be cautious and careful about his intentions and who he associates with, especially with this guy in verse 7. Now a certain man of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord. His name was Doeg the Edomite, the chief of Saul's herdsmen. We don't know anything about him. He's just a certain man. He was detained there. And David saw him, recognized him. Okay, he's one of Saul's servants. I need to be careful. He might just go to Saul and tell Saul where I am. But he's already been seen. And here is this particular individual, Doeg, who is lurking in the shadows of this priest village and could be one who can serve to be a spy for Saul. So he has to be cautious. He has to be careful. If you jump ahead to chapter 22, verse 22, at the end, I know I'm letting the cat out of the bag here, what's going to happen here, but he says, here's David's response, I knew on that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul. So he's already suspicious, thinking, oh no, here's this guy, he sees me. Well, verse 8, with Ahimelech still, then David said to Ahimelech, Then have you not here a spear or a sword at hand? For I have brought neither my sword nor my weapons with me, because the king's business required haste. Again, concealing that, it definitely required haste. The king's business was to try to capture David and kill him, and he needed to get out of town as quickly as possible. And so he's without his weapons, weighing him down. So now he asks, what do you have here? And the priest said, the sword of Goliath, the Philistine, whom you struck down in the valley of Elah. Behold, it is here wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you will take that, take it, for there is none but that here. David said, there is none like that. Give it to me. So he's able to arm himself, takes the sword. And so here's this Ahimelech, Doeg, the Edomite, the first encounter with him. But I want you to be aware that what David revealed to Ahimelech was a simple statement that I'm on a special expedition, a secret mission from Saul. Give me some provisions. Okay, we'll serve you, we'll serve the king, we'll meet needs, whatever it is, whatever you need, we'll give that to you. No problem, right? It becomes a huge problem. Next, David has to move on. In verse 10, the next A. Well, let me show you this. Achish from Gath. Verse 10, and David rose and fled that day from Saul and went to Achish, the king of Gath. That's a Philistine city, a Philistine stronghold. Leaves the borders of Israel, goes to his enemies. And what's he doing there? He's going to seek asylum here, hoping to find asylum here. Because he can't dwell in Benjamin. He can't dwell anywhere in Israel, because everybody's going to be looking for him, because Saul is put his name and put his face on the wanted posters around town. I'm just, you know, rhetorically speaking. But here we have him fleeing to the Philistines. Is that a help? Is that going to be good for him? Will he get asylum there? Verse 11, the servants of Achish said to him, is not this David the king of the land? Did they not sing to one another of him in dances? Saul struck down his thousands and David his 10,000s. And David took note of these words to heart and was much afraid of Achish, the king of Gath. Okay, this is not going to be, he learns real quickly, a place where I can get asylum. They're afraid of me. They know who I am. I am a threat to them. What am I going to do? What is he going to do? He thought that his past military exploits maybe had been forgotten. They're not. Or maybe he thought that the word of Saul's vendetta against him would win them a welcome and saying, well, he's an enemy of Saul now. We'll take him in. We'll have him part of our army. Maybe that's a hope. That didn't work out that way. So what does he do? Verse 13. He changed his behavior before them and pretended to be insane in their hands and made marks on the doors of the gate and let his spittle run down his beard. Then Achish said to his servants, behold, you see the man is mad. Why then have you brought him to me? Do I lack madmen that you have brought me this fellow to behave as a madman in my presence? Shall this fellow come into my house? And so he acts insane. And that's how he's going to get himself out of this situation. His ploy incited their disgust, and so he has to leave. There's a couple of psalms that are written here at this point. Let me point those to you, out to you. Psalm 56, turn over to there. Psalm 56. Just the first four verses. This is a psalm written by David. It's called According to the Dove on Far-Off Terebinths, a miktam of David, when the Philistines seized him in Gath. So they had taken him, they brought him before Achish, and he has to pretend to be insane to get away. He says this, be gracious to me, O God, for man tramples on me. All day long, an attacker oppresses me. My enemies trample on me all day long, for many attack me proudly. When I am afraid, I put my trust in you, in God, whose word I praise. In God I trust. I shall not be afraid. What can flesh do to me? So clearly we see his fear, but we also see his trust at this time. He may be acting insane, kind of doing some things in his own ways to get away, and yet there's still that heart in him of trust. Psalm 34 is another psalm that is written there of this time and in this place. Let me take you now to where he goes. We'll call that the Adullam Cave. See the A's? That's what I'm trying to connect here. Ahimelech, Achish, now the Adullam Cave. Chapter 22. David departed from there. Can't get asylum from his enemies. He can't stay in Gibeah because they're on the hunt looking for him. He can't stay with the priests. At one point he had visited Samuel, but that was short-lived because Saul went after Samuel and David, and the Lord stepped in there and Saul was prophesying and allowed for David's escape. And with the priests, here's Doeg, there's people there. So he can't be in Israel, at least in the public eye. So what does he do? He departs from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. And when his brothers and all his father's house heard it, they went down there to him, and everyone who was in distress, and everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was bitter in soul gathered to him, and he became captain over them, and there were with him about 400 men. So here's the Adullam Cave, important part of David's life. He had to seek out a stronghold in the wilderness in Judah where they might find a long-term safe place for him and his men. So he's going to have to find a hideout. And this is where this warlord time of David begins, where he has a hideout, people come to him, and now he has a small army with him, and he begins to work from that position and be on the run when chased, but still work with a certain amount of power and influence and exploits. And this is where these exploits begin. This will be the start of these warlord years. 400 troops raises up to about 600 men at one time. Hebrews 11 speaks about people like this who are wandering about in deserts and mountains and dens and caves of the earth, those who by faith find themselves in situations like this sometimes. David is the man of faith. David is the man who is after God's own heart, and he's wandering in the deserts and in caves, hiding out from his oppressors. Where's the Adullam Cave? Well, here's the Judean wilderness. This is a picture of the Judean wilderness in Judah, kind of southern Israel. As you can see, it's desert-like, and there's a whole bunch of little cavernous type of areas, easy to hide, caves everywhere, places you can get yourself lost real fast. And the Adullam Cave is something like this, probably not so much in the desert. Here's some wadis. If you put yourself down there in a typical part of the wilderness, you can get lost here. I don't know how you can hide 400 men, but you can get lost. You can keep out of hiding or keep in hiding and keep out of sight from the king unless the king starts searching and has the whole army looking for you. You got to be on the move, but this is the type of life that he's going to live for years. He moves to a place in the Elah Valley. Elah Valley is the place where Goliath was killed by David and the armies there. They met within that valley in the brook of Elah. This is the brook here. Maybe one of those stones killed Goliath. We don't know. This is the brook here, but it's at the head of this valley that works its way up into the highlands in the Israel is where what they believe the Adullam Cave is found. Here's a picture up above of where that valley is. Can you see the brook that goes down the middle of it right here? He's either up on this hill or that hill, and the Philistines on the other, and they meet in the middle. That's where Goliath and David met head to head. You can go there in Israel and visit. That's a cool place. But the Adullam Cave will be up in the high ground. So somewhere down in this area is where that picture was, up in the higher grounds, up in the deeper cavernous areas above that valley would be where this Adullam Cave is found. And here is what they believe is a picture or a place that might be something like that cave. A few other pictures, another cave, the inside of that cave. So he's going to find a hideout. This is where he's going to live. And while he's there, his family comes to him, because his family's not very far away. Bethlehem is close to this area, maybe about 5 miles or so. And so his family can't consider themselves safe. They're a threat to Saul as well. So they make their way down there, and he would eventually deliver them up to Moab. That's the next verses. Verse 3, David went from there to Mizpah of Moab, and he said to the king of Moab, "Please let my father and my mother stay with you till I know what God will do for me." And he left them with the king of Moab, and they stayed with him all the time that David was in the stronghold. The stronghold is the cave of Adullam. He then the prophet Gad said to David, "Do not remain in the stronghold. Depart and go into the land of Judah." So David departed and went into the forest of Hereth. So here he is in this place that is called the Adullam Cave and the stronghold. He takes care of his family, sets them kind of in the care of another king, one of what would be an asylum place. And one by one, what's happening now, as we read before, other outcasts are gathered to him. Those who are in debt, those who are in distress, those who were having trouble under the reign of Saul, and they come to him, they gather to this man as their new leader, and this is going to be the people who would make up his army and those who would make up what would be his future kingdom and those associates of his kingdom. They're outcasts, outcasts from Israel, created by Israel's poor leadership at this time. Useless to Saul, but David, to them, he became their warlord. This rabble came to David, and many of them became his chief officers as he later rose to the throne. Now, in this time, with this group, he began to do some exploits. And what those meant, what I mean by that, he was to go out and wherever he would be, and he would come to the aid of villages and cities who were under the distress or the attacks of the Philistines or other armies. And they would come in and they would battle for them. And they would fight for them. They would protect their crops. They would protect their flocks. They would protect their wives and children and their homelands and whatnot. And so there would be these lightning strike, like guerrilla warfare from David, this warlord, upon the Philistines. Saul's not doing this. This is David. And so the people would be won over by this. This is the type of mini army that would come in and be their aid and be their help. And then they would disappear after their exploits back into the wilderness, back into the forests. Do I got a picture of the forests? Here's a little map. You probably can't read that. That was a bad map to show you. But in the middle there is the forest of Hereth. Dead Sea over here, Jerusalem up here. Saul is in this area to the north, Bethlehem here, and the forest kind of this area here. And it's either desert really high or forests in places like this. You can get lost there too. And this is what the prophet said. You need to get out of here, out of the stronghold. People will look for these strongholds, but you can go and wander in the forests like this and they won't be able to see you, and they would have a hard time detecting your whereabouts. Another picture of the forest of Hereth. And it's in this time other psalms are written. You familiar with Psalm 57? I gave it a title when I preached it. Dave in the Cave, Psalm 57. Dave when he was in the cave. Let me read those few of those verses with you. This is at this time again. This is the heart of David. Where is he at? What's he thinking? A miktam of David when he fled from Saul in the cave. The cave. "Be merciful to me, O God, be merciful to me, for in you my soul takes refuge. In the shadow of your wings I will take refuge till the storms of destruction pass by. I cry out to God Most High, to God who fulfills his purpose for me. He will send from heaven and save me. He will put to shame him who tramples on me. God will send out his steadfast love and his faithfulness. My soul is in the midst of lions. I lie down among fiery beasts, the children of man whose teeth are spears and arrows, whose tongues are sharp swords. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be over all the earth. And as you could see the point, here we have this worshipful heart in the midst of great distress and danger. No one he can trust in the land of Judah. Everyone could be a spy and everyone can be a Doeg. So I have to trust in my God at this point. Psalm 142 is another psalm that is written at this time. Let's move ahead to the next A, or Aleph, the assassination of Nob. Assassination. Annihilation, you can say. Probably could have used that term. Verse 6. Now Saul heard that David was discovered, and that the men who were with him, Saul was sitting at Gibeah under the tamarisk tree in the height with his spear in his hand, and all his servants were standing about him. And Saul said to his servants who stood about him, "Hear now, people of Benjamin, will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards? Will he make you all commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds, that all of you have conspired against me? No one discloses to me when my son makes a covenant with the son of Jesse. None of you is sorry for me or discloses to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as at this day." So here is what I'll say the pity party of Saul, or the paranoia of Saul, where he is consumed with David. He wants to get at David, and he comes to find out, or at least he's suspicious of everybody. I mean, there's a suspicious spirit here, a conspiracy spirit here, that everybody is working and conspiring against me and supporting David. And who's he accusing? His own tribe. "You sons of Benjamin, hear what I've said. Are you working for the son of Jesse against me?" And they start accusing them of same stuff you're hearing in Washington today. It's kind of a quid pro quo type thing. He's paying you off to support his venture to destroy me. Is he going to give you vineyards? Is he going to give you a place in his kingdom if you work on his behalf to destroy his enemy? It's in this time where he's spewing out these conspiracies and suspicions that someone speaks up. And here he is. Guess who talks? Verse 9. "Then answered Doeg, the Edomite, who stood by the servants of Saul, 'I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob, to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub. And he inquired of the Lord for him and gave him provisions and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine.'" Interesting. So now Doeg speaks up. This is kind of sneaky of Doeg. Doeg did not hear the conversation specifically of David and Ahimelech. I'm not sure if he was actually there. He saw what went on, and he may have suspected that something was going on, and he may put words in their mouth, and of course he is making it seem like Ahimelech is on David's side, supporting David, helping David. But did he understand that David lied to Ahimelech? Ahimelech's caught in the crossfire here, and he is now exposed as being one who is seen as an enemy when really he's not doing anything that would be opposed to Saul. But this is how it's pictured now. Doeg comes in, opens his mouth, and causes a great issue. And now Saul has to respond. Verse 11. "Then the king sent to summon Ahimelech, the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all his father's house, the priests who were at Nob. And all of them came to the king. And Saul said, 'Hear now, son of Ahitub.' And he answered, 'Here am I, my lord.' Saul said to him, "Why have you conspired against me, you and the son of Jesse, in that you have given him bread and a sword and have inquired of God for him so that he has risen against me to lie in wait as at this day?" Of course, Ahimelech can say, "Well, yeah, I gave him a sword. I gave him bread because I thought he was doing your business, not conspiring against you, not lying in wait. I'm not doing that. I'm not supporting a coup of the king." And Ahimelech answered him, "And who among all your servants is so faithful as David, who is the king's son-in-law and captain over your bodyguard and honored in your house? Is today the first time that I've inquired of God for him? No, let not the king impute anything to his servant or to all the house of my father, for your servant has known nothing of all this, much or little." I don't know what you're talking about. I've always given him counsel whenever he's asked. That's always public knowledge. You're making accusations that are not accurate here. Verse 18, the king said, "You shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and all your father's house." The king said to the guard who stood about him, "Turn and kill the priests of the Lord, because their hand also is with David, and they knew that he fled and did not disclose it to me." But the servants of the king would not put out their hand to strike the priests of the Lord. At least they have some integrity. At least they fear the Lord in this. These are the priests of the Lord. Here is Saul making a false accusation, believing a lie, accusing Ahimelech falsely, and ready to slay him, commanding that he be slain. And this is the priest of God. Who's going to cover and do the work of the Lord in the altar? This is not even on the mind of Saul. At this point, it's all about protecting his own interests, killing David, getting at David, and whoever gets in the way will suffer my wrath. This is a man who truly is out of control. We're starting to get deep into the mind of this King Saul. There's a madness here. Nobody is safe. Everyone is to be suspected. And he'll stop at nothing to get what he wants. And that is to destroy David. And he's got allies on his side, Doegs, to be his counsel, to lie and to show and to reveal and serve as spies for his purposes and for their purposes, for sure. Well, what does he do? They won't raise their sword to kill the priests, but then who does? Then the king said to Doeg, "You turn and strike the priests." And Doeg the Edomite turned and struck down the priests. He killed on that day 85 priests or persons who wore the linen ephod. And Nob, the city of the priests, he put to the sword, both man and women, child and infant, ox, donkey, and sheep, he put to the sword. This is a slaughter. This is a genocide. Because of what was really started with David coming to him, concealing and lying about his intentions and saying, "I'm actually here because the king has sent me on a secret mission." That's not actually true. So Ahimelech's caught in the lie, or at least the concealing. Doeg sees this, wants to gain the upper hand and get an advantage in the kingdom of Saul, and so he spills the beans about David seeing Ahimelech and implying that, you know what, here's one guy who's on David's side, and the end result is the death of this king and 85 others and the whole village of Nob, a slaughter. And this is blood, innocent blood on the hands of both Saul and Doeg. Doeg's viciously committing this in the village of Nob. I don't even think that's what Saul had in mind, but he did. He went after it all. This, by the way, fulfills the curse of Eli in 1 Samuel 2:31. If you turn back there, just a note on that. This is narrative, and this is how things come out, and God made this statement from a man of God to Eli, who was the predecessor to Samuel. In chapter 2, in verse 31, "Behold, the days are coming when I will cut off your strength and the strength of your father's house, so that there will not be an old man in your house Then in distress you will look with envious eye on all the prosperity that shall be bestowed on Israel, and there shall not be an old man in your house forever. The only one of you whom I shall not cut off from my altar shall be spared to weep his eyes out, to grieve his heart, and all the descendants of your house shall die by the sword of men. And that sounds like a pretty serious judgment. And these men, Ahimelech, are the descendants of Eli. They're the descendants of the priests, the Levites, and this family. So we're left here at this point with this slaughter in chapter 22, crying out for justice. This is wrong. And someone needs to replace this guy on the throne. Someone needs to bring justice. Someone needs to bring correction here. Something has to happen to turn the tide. Otherwise, Saul, in this madman mind of his, will drive the nation in really into a self-inflicted disaster and destruction. And it's heading that way. But God is raising up David. God is raising up David at this time. David's not a general in the army standing beside Saul waiting to just kind of slip in. He is on the run. He's living in caves and now walking about as a homeless man, a warlord living in forests. That's where he is right now, but that's the testing ground that God has put him in. Let me give you one last aleph here. I'll take you to Abiathar, the priest. Verse 20. But one of the sons of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled after David. And Abiathar told David that Saul had killed the priests of the Lord. And David said to Abiathar, I knew on that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul, I have occasioned the death of all the priests or the persons of your father's house. Stay with me. Do not be afraid, for he who seeks my life seeks your life. With me you shall be in safekeeping. So the one priest that's left, and this Abiathar would become a major player in what would be the kingdom of David, in the priesthood side, in the work, in the service of the tabernacle. So he comes and reveals what happens, tells of his family's death. It's a vicious scene, and David is the one who acknowledges at this point, as you could see, I'm the one who's occasioned this. It's because of me that this has happened. He's out to kill me and anyone associated with me. So he has come to this realization and once again reinforced that it is a crime and a death sentence to be in association with David in the eyes of Saul. And so this is a terrible position to be in and a lot of burden for him to be on. And so he takes him in and says, just join our clan, stay here, because he who's trying to kill you is trying to kill me too. We're together in this. And that night, turn with me to Psalm 52. He writes this psalm. He writes this with these words, and you kind of get a little more in the depth of what's happening here. This is a psalm, a maskil of David, Psalm 52, when Doeg, the Edomite, came and told Saul, David has come to the house of Ahimelech. So he learns of this, and he writes, why do you boast, O evil, O mighty man? The steadfast love of God endures all the day. Your tongue plots destruction like a sharp razor, you worker of deceit. You love evil more than good, and lying more than speaking what is right. You love all words that devour, O deceitful tongue. O God, but God will break you down forever. He will snatch and tear you from your tent. He will uproot you from the land of the living. The righteous shall see and fear and shall laugh at him, saying, see the man who would not make God his refuge, but trusted in the abundance of his riches and sought refuge in his own destruction. You can, that last line, you can translate that, sought refuge in his own works of destruction. But I am like a green olive tree in the house of God. I trust in the steadfast love of God forever and ever. I will thank you forever because you have done it. I will wait for your name, for it is good in the presence of the godly. You want to mark a couple of things. Note the contrasts here of the uprooted tree, that is Doeg, and the flourishing green olive tree, and that is David. David, who is trusting in the steadfast love of God, considers God his refuge, and not doing all things in his own power for his own advantage and his own wealth. He's trusting and waiting on the name of God. Notice the contrast of that trust. You could allude here, at least Doeg's intentions, why he would reveal that would be for his own advantage. And so he's willing to bring out what would be a false accusation, leading Saul to destroy the priests and to get himself in an advantageous place in the court of Saul. That is the one who is Doeg, and that's his trust, not in God. But David is the one who trusts in God as his refuge and in his steadfast love. So Doeg had become a sneaky eavesdropper to things not meant for his ears to hear. He had misinterpreted it, what happened, and he delivered that false report to Saul, and the end result was hundreds of people innocently slaughtered by his hand, by his own hand. What a picture. So, whose side do you want to be on? You want to be in the court of David, in the company of Doeg, or do you want to be in the tents, in the caves and the mountains and the trees and the forests on the run with David? Do you want to be in the court of Saul, who's a madman, who's out to protect his own interests and will use anybody for that advantage and conspire and suspect anybody? He's almost like a Joseph Stalin of his day, killing anybody he suspects of suspicion of some type of conspiracy against him. And then there's David, who's on the run, hiding in the trees, waiting on God and trusting that the Lord will protect him and establish him like a green olive tree. So take care of the company you keep. That's a simple, practical thing. Seek out God as your refuge and his people as your companions. And that is a lesson of this text as we see David in the wilderness. We'll pick up next time as we keep going and following David in his steps there. So let's close in prayer. Lord, I do thank you for your word in revealing a little more of the life of this man and the different things that are going on here, different events, different people. There's certainly some characters, a cast of characters here. Those who will side with David and those who will side with Saul. There's certainly a mind that is at play here in different places, a mind that seeks self, that seeks in a prideful way to establish himself, and then there's the mind who seeks the honor of God, seeks the Lord as a refuge, that rests in the steadfast love of God. This is the example we want to see, Lord, and live by. We thank you for the life of David on the pages of Scripture that you teach us. Instruct our hearts to trust, instruct our hearts to be faithful, to watch over our hearts for the type of deception and the type of conspiring that is of the flesh, that is evil, that is sinful, that does not seek to honor you. And may we repent of those things, and may we be like David and not like Doeg. Thank you for our morning and our afternoon and this evening and the time that we've had to gather together in worship and in the Word and in prayer. And may you bless this to our hearts, to our soul, as we go from here throughout the rest of this week in seeking to serve you and seeking to be like David, a man or a woman after God's own heart. So I thank you and I pray these things in Christ's name. Amen.